I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with the third lecture on Plato's dialogue, The Gorgias. I very much appreciate all of you who are sticking with it. I think there's nothing more important, frankly, than philosophy. And I think the greatest philosopher of them all is Plato. And every educated person needs to have some knowledge of Plato. And this is, for many of you, a first start, a first introduction. So welcome. I am returning to the dialogue after the discussion with Polus. Polus is a foreigner to Athens. He's a student of Gorgias, the great sophist, and he had a back and forth with Socrates, which brought up a number of very important issues. And at a certain point, when Socrates basically starts arguing that it's better to suffer injustice than to do injustice, better for your soul. And then he goes on and he really starts pummeling poor Polus and saying, in fact, Polus, if there's any use of rhetoric at all, which is what Gorgias is the teacher of, right? If there's any use of rhetoric at all, it should be to accuse oneself before the courts. If one's done wrong, someone can get punished, duly punished, and have one's soul purged of any vice, of any illness. And he says, moreover, your worst enemy is the sort of person whom you would not accuse before the courts, but rather would help evade justice, because justice would be the thing that would purge your enemy of his evil and make him a good person. And of course, therefore, if you want him to suffer, the best thing you could do is help him get away with his crimes forever. At this point, Callicles jumps in and he says, and this is at 481b. And at this point, Callicles jumps in and he turns to Socrates' friend, Chaerephon, and he says, tell me, Chaerephon, is Socrates in earnest about this or is he joking? And Chaerephon says, I think he's in dead earnest about this, Callicles. There's nothing like asking him, though. There's something kind of odd here about the use of the flunkies. Socrates' flunky is Chaerephon. Gorgias' flunky is Polus. These guys sort of are treated as intermediaries. Why doesn't Callias just ask Socrates himself? Why does he turn to Chaerephon? It's a peculiar thing. This isn't an actual conversation that's been tape recorded. This is an artful creation, and therefore everything in it has a purpose. And I wonder what the purpose of that is. What's the commentary here? What's the message here in having somebody like Callias turn to Chaerephon rather than Socrates? And Callicles says, by the gods, just the thing I'm eager to do. Tell me, Socrates, are we to take you as being in earnest now or joking? For if you are in earnest and these things you're saying are really true, won't this human life of ours be turned upside down and won't everything we do evidently be the opposite of what we should do? So Callicles says, Socrates, this idea that it's better to suffer injustice than to do injustice, this will overthrow our world. Socrates says, well, Callicles, if human beings didn't share common experiences, some sharing one, others sharing another, but one of us had some unique experience not shared by others, it wouldn't be easy for him to communicate what he experienced to the other. So communication is based on shared experience. Good point. I say this because I realize that you and I are both now actually sharing a common experience. Each of us is a lover of two objects. I of Alcibiades, Clinias's son, and of philosophy. And you of the Demos, the people of Athens, and the Demos, who's the son of Pyrilampes. Pyrilampes was Plato's stepfather, and so Demos was Plato's stepbrother. I notice that in each case, you're unable to contradict your beloved. We're getting a sense of who Callicles is. Callicles is, as far as we know, maybe just a character created by Plato. He's only attested in this dialogue. There are no contemporary or later historical sources that mention his name, except to mention the Callicles of the Gorgias. That doesn't necessarily mean he's a fictional invention. He could have just been one of the many upper-class, ambitious Athenians who studied sophistry with a goal to having a political career, attaining political power. And we're getting a sense of this by saying that he's in love with the demos. He's in love with the people. He wants to rule the people. And to rule the people, what does he do? He flatters the people. And this goes back to the distinction between rhetoric as flattery, which panders and corrupts, as opposed to the true political art, which edifies people and builds them up and sometimes tells them things that they need to hear but don't want to hear. Flatterers tell you what you want to hear, not necessarily what you need to hear. Basically, what Socrates is saying is that he's got a bad relationship with the demos of Athens because he's unable, he says, you're unable to oppose what your beloved say or propose. So that if somebody heard you say what you do on their account and was amazed at how absurd that is, you'd probably say, if you were minded to tell him the truth, that unless somebody stops your beloveds from saying what they say, you'll never stop saying these things either. Basically, he repeats the things that the people repeat, or that demos, his boyfriend, repeats. In that case, you must believe that you're bound to hear me say things like that too. So he's saying, you are a flatterer and a panderer, and you can't say no. And therefore, you assume that I'm the same kind of person. And it couldn't be wronger, Callias. You couldn't be wronger, because what I love is philosophy. And philosophy, unlike the people of Athens, is not fickle. The demos of Athens is the realm of opinion, and opinion is always shifting and changing. Philosophy is the pursuit of truth, which is unchanging. Philosophy says the same things over and over again, whereas the demos is constantly changing its mind. I'm in love with philosophy, therefore I follow what philosophy says. You're in love with the demos, and therefore you follow what the demos says, and that means you're constantly contradicting yourself. This is not a very flattering picture of Callias, but it's a picture of any people pleaser. Callicles, I'm sorry. It's a portrait of any kind of person who's primarily concerned with pleasing other people rather than concerned with pursuing the truth. You want an example of a people pleaser who causes us enormous amounts of frustration because he could do so much good if he were just more principled and less desirous of saying yes to people he needs to say no to. That's Elon Musk, right? Elon Musk has some very solid principles, and he wants Twitter to be a free speech platform. I think he's a genuine liberal, classical liberal type. But there are people who are buttonholing him and pressuring him and badgering him and bullying him, mostly organizations like the Anti-Defamation League of the Circumcised, right? He can't say no to these people. And so he's buffeted around, and he would be so much better for the world if he were more of a man of principle and less of a man who wants to please the last person who's had his ear. Most politicians and public figures are people pleasers. And that means that to people like me, who are principled and pursuers of truth, they're enormously frustrating to watch because they're willing to overthrow solid principles or affirm absolutely deadly principles because it pleases the person they're speaking to in the moment, right? He's saying, Socrates is saying, that Callicles is this kind of guy. So let's continue. We're in 482, around B in the margin. He says, what philosophy says always stays the same, and she's saying things that now astound you, although you were present when they were said. So either refute her and show that doing what's unjust without paying what is due for it is not the ultimate of all bad things, as I just now was saying it is, or else, if you leave this unrefuted, then by the dog, the god of the Egyptians, Callicles, Callicles will not agree with you, Callicles, but will be dissonant with you all your life long. He's saying Callicles will disagree with Callicles. In other words, you will be in a contradictory state of mind. And yet, for my part, my good man, I think it's better to have my lyre or a chorus that I might lead out of tune and dissonant, and to have the vast majority of men disagree with me and contradict me, than to be out of harmony with myself, to contradict myself, though I'm only one person. So this is a wonderful speech. And notice that Socrates is making speeches. When he was talking to Gorgias and Polus, he was very, very pushy, kind of rude, actually, in demanding that they give short answers to his questions. Now he's giving speeches, which I think is very interesting. And Callicles matches him with speeches. And this becomes more of a contest of speeches rather than a dialogue, at least at first. But there's something very important here. Socrates says it's better to be in harmony with oneself than to be in harmony with other people. Why is that? And in what sense is he talking about being in harmony with oneself? Well, there are two senses of harmony here. The sense that's out on the surface that's most important is simply having non-contradictory opinions. And again, if you follow the crowd and you take up opinions because it pleases the people around you, your mind is going to be a junk heap of contradictory opinions because the people are contradictory. They contradict one another, they contradict themselves, and if you're trying to please them rather than pursue truth, you're going to be full of nonsense. The other sense of harmony comes in later, appears later, which is the harmony of the soul, which has to do with virtue, spiritual health. I guess you can call this the harmony of the mind, lack of logical contradiction, but there's a broader sort of moral or spiritual harmony that comes in later. And again, pursuing that kind of moral or spiritual harmony often requires that one be out of tune with the people around you. Because oftentimes, most of the time, the people around us are morally lax and sloppy. And if you harmonize with them, you're going to be out of harmony with yourself, intellectually and morally. That's what Socrates is saying. Callicles responds. He says, Socrates, I think you're grandstanding in these speeches, acting like a true crowd pleaser. Here you are playing to the crowd now that Polus has had the same thing happen to him that he accused Gorgias of letting you do to him. For he said, didn't he, that when Gorgias was asked by you whether he would teach anyone who came to him wanting to learn oratory, but without expertise in what's just, Gorgias was ashamed and out of deference to human custom, since people would take it ill if a person refused, he said that he'd teach his students to be just. And because Gorgias agreed on this point, he said he was forced to contradict himself, just the thing you like. He ridiculed you. He's talking about Polus now. He ridiculed you at the time, and rightly so, as I think anyhow. And now the very same thing has happened to him, to Polus. And for this same reason, I don't approve of Polus. He agreed with you that doing what's just is more shameful than suffering it. As a result of this admission, he was bound and gagged by you in the discussion, too ashamed to say what he thought. Although you claim to be pursuing the truth, you're in fact bringing the discussion around to the sort of crowd-pleasing vulgarities that are admirable only by law. That's nomos. And not by late nature, the Greek is phusis. And these, nature and law, are for the most part opposed to each other. So if a person is ashamed and doesn't dare to say what he thinks, he's forced to contradict himself. This is, in fact, the clever trick that you've thought of, with which you work your mischief in your discussions. If a person makes a statement in terms of law, you slyly question him in terms of nature. If he makes it in terms of nature, you question him in terms of law. Okay, let's pause here. This is very clever. Let's talk about nature and law here. The Greek word for law is nomos, and the Greek word for nature is phusis. The distinction between nature and law is absolutely central to early Greek natural philosophy and to the sophists. The early Greek natural philosophers thought that nature is the thing that stays the same. And because it stays the same, it's always the same, it's good. They identified the good with the permanent, with the permanently present. And this is something that's older than Plato. This is the earliest Greek natural philosophers looked to nature and saw it as good. They looked at nomoi, or laws, and the better translation here is conventions, social conventions, norms, if you will. They looked at norms, and they discovered very quickly that norms are relative to time and place. Different peoples have different norms, and norms change over time. Because the good is the permanently present and unchanging, the realm of nomoi is therefore contemptible. It's the realm of flux. Now, the sophists believed that you should get into that realm of flux, that realm of nomoi, that realm of shifting public opinions. You should roll up your sleeves, and you should be liberated from all moral scruples, which are just conventions. And you should get as much as you can for yourself. Grab off as much as you can. Look out for number one. Not be held back by norms, because they're all nonsense. What do you follow then? Well, you follow nature. And you follow nature in this sense. You have desires. And this is what's very clear about Callicles. Callicles believes that there is a right and wrong written into nature. And the right and wrong written into nature is basically survival of the fittest, and the strongest get the most for themselves. But it's a very interesting idea. He believes that there is a right by nature, that right and wrong are not just conventions. So he looks to nature for guidance in matters of morals. And he sees nature red in tooth and claw. He sees competition. He sees the strong dominating the weak. He sees some people getting more than others. And he says, that's the law of nature. We'll see more about this as we go forward. And he's accusing Socrates of being in bad faith, because he thinks that Socrates believes the same things that he does, that basically norms are conventional for the most part, and that we should follow nature. But he sees Socrates acting in bad faith by appealing to conventional ideas like the shamefulness of doing injustice. He shamed Gorgias into contradicting himself. He shamed Polus into contradicting himself. But Callicles won't be shamed here. He is a person who's entirely emancipated from convention, at least he thinks he is. And therefore, he's going to stand for nature, and he's calling out Socrates for exploiting conventional morals, grandstanding to the public. Now, of course, if Callicles is a sophist, a real sophist, he should be admiring Socrates for exploiting people's attachment to conventional norms. right? That's how you win in law court. That's how you win in politics. You don't go out there and say, all these ideals that you believe in are complete bunk, people, and then win. What you do is you go out there and you talk about traditional moral values or freedom, whatever nonsense the segment of the public you're trying to pander to believes in. So in a way, there's something more philosophical than sophistical about Callicles here. Callicles is indignant that Socrates is exploiting people's residual attachment to what he thinks are fake norms in order to win an argument. But that's what the sophists do. That's part of the job. But he has a sense of moral intellectual probity here that makes him indignant when he sees Socrates doing this. So I think this is kind of fascinating. What I'm getting at here is that Callicles is almost a philosopher. His mentality is the mentality of a philosopher. So in what sense is his mentality philosophical? Well, first of all, he stands on the side of nature. He thinks that there are norms in nature, which is a huge step forward. It's part of the Socratic revolution in philosophy to look for a natural right, to not just dismiss norms as conventions, but just try and see norms written into nature. He's mentally emancipated from convention. He has a high sense of probity, of honesty, and he's contemptuous of Socrates for, as he sees it, exploiting people's residual attachment to merely conventional morals. So that is really the profile of a philosopher. And Socrates sees that too. He's a contradictory character. Yes, he's embarked on the life of pursuing power, which means that he has to be a demagogue and a flatterer and a panderer. But there's something philosophical about the soul of Callicles, and Socrates is going to try and zero in on that and use that to win him around in the end. So let's move forward and look at his account of nature and convention, nature and norms, and how they conflict in society. So this is at 483 in A. Just before it says B, Callicles says, "By nature, all that is worse is also more shameful, like suffering what's unjust. Whereas by law, doing it is more shameful. No man would put up with suffering what's unjust. Only a slave would do so, one who is better dead than alive, who, when he's treated unjustly and abused, can't protect himself or anyone he cares about. I believe that the people who institute our laws are the weak and the many. They do this, and they assign praise and blame with themselves and with their own advantage in mind." Basically, this is Nietzsche long before there was Nietzsche. What's he saying here? He's saying that we are ruled by slave morality. He actually talks about a slave just before this. The weak and the many, the people who might not be actual slaves, but they're certainly fit to be slaves. These people rule society, and they assign praise and blame with themselves and their own advantage in mind. They're setting up moral standards that put themselves in a flattering light and put their enemies in a negative light. He goes on, "They're afraid of the more powerful among men, the ones who are capable of having a greater share. And so they say that getting more than one's share is shameful and unjust, and that doing what's unjust is trying to get more than one's share. They do this so that those people won't get a greater share than they. I think they like getting an equal share since they are inferior. These are the reasons why trying to get a greater share than most is said to be unjust and shameful by law, and why they call it doing what's unjust. But I believe that nature itself reveals that it's a just thing for the better man and the more capable man to have a greater share than the worse man and the less capable man. Nature shows that this is so in many places, both among the other animals and in whole cities and races of men. It shows that this is what justice has been decided to be, that the superior rule the inferior and have a greater share than they. For what sort of justice does Xerxes go by when he campaigned against Greece, or his father when he campaigned against Scythia? Interestingly enough, Xerxes was defeated by the Greeks, and Darius I, his father, was defeated by the Scythians. But let's leave that aside. That is a little puzzle that we could ponder over later. Countless other such examples could be mentioned. I believe that these men do these things in accordance with the nature of what's just. Yes, by Zeus, in accordance with the law of nature. This is the earliest occurrence of the idea of the law of nature in our intellectual tradition, which I think is very, very interesting. Yes, by Zeus, in accordance with the law of nature, and presumably not with the one we institute, namely conventions. We mold the best and the most powerful among us, taking them while they're still young, like lion cubs, and with charms and incantations, we subdue them into slavery, telling them that one is supposed to get no more than his fair share, and that that's what's admirable and just. I believe that if a man whose nature is equal to it were to arise, one who had shaken off, torn apart, and escaped all this, who had trampled underfoot our documents, our tricks and charms, and all our laws that violate nature, he, the slave, would rise up and be revealed as our master and hear the justice of nature, the natural right, would shine forth. You can translate that natural right. The Greek is phuseos dikaion. Phusis is nature. Dikai is right. So natural right or justice of nature. Natural right would shine forth. He basically, what he's saying is, look, the gods are always stealing from one another. Heracles drove off Geryon's cattle and he hadn't paid for them, but Heracles was the stronger man, right? He did this on the ground that this is what's just by nature, and that cattle and all other possessions of those who are worse and inferior belong to the one who's better and superior. This is the truth of the matter, as you will acknowledge if you abandon philosophy and move on to more important things. Now, this is very interesting. Once he talks about natural right, then he talks about how you need to abandon philosophy. That's kind of peculiar. He's very much a philosophical thinker in generating this position. This is a philosophy. It's social Darwinism. It's Nietzsche. And yet he says, we need to leave off philosophy. So what's going on here? And he goes on, he says, philosophy is no doubt a delightful thing, Socrates, as long as one is exposed to it in moderation at the appropriate time of life. He thinks it's part of a good gentleman's education. But if you take it too seriously, it's your undoing. It's unbecoming. And he says that you, Socrates, are basically unbecoming. You have spent too much time philosophizing and you haven't grown up, you haven't graduated, and you haven't gone out into the real world. And what is the real world? The real world is the world of politics. So at 484D, he talks about somebody like Socrates who spent too much time studying philosophy. He says, such people turn out to be inexperienced in the laws of their city or in the kind of speech one must use to deal with people on matters of business, whether in public or private, inexperienced also in human pleasures and appetites, and in short, inexperienced in the ways of human beings altogether. So when they venture into some private or political activity, they become a laughingstock. We're supposed to think here with the laughingstock of what? The Clouds by Aristophanes, the play that makes Socrates a laughingstock. And he says, I suppose men in politics look like laughingstocks when they venture into your pursuits too. but when you venture into the political realm, you look like a fool. This is all, I think, foreshadowing, of course. Well, it's foreshadowing because dramatically it happens before the trial of Socrates. But what he's doing is he's writing after the trial of Socrates, and he's laying the premises for how Socrates ended up on trial for his life. That's part of the agenda here. He talks about how it's not shameful to study philosophy when you're a boy, but it is shameful to pursue philosophy when you're a man. Just like it's shameful for an adult to walk around stuttering like a child. And the reference to stuttering like a child is a swipe at Alcibiades, whom Socrates has mentioned earlier, who was famous for his stutter. So let's go forward at 485e. He talks about how a philosopher spends his time hiding, whispering in a corner with three or four boys, never uttering anything well-bred, important, or apt. Socrates, I do have a rather warm regard for you. I find myself feeling what Zethus, whose words I recall just now, felt toward Amphion in Euripides' play. In fact, the sorts of things he said to his brother come to my mind to say to you. You're neglecting the things you should devote yourself to, Socrates, and though your spirit's nature is so noble, you show yourself to the world in the shape of a boy. You couldn't put a speech together correctly before councils of justice or utter any plausible or persuasive sound, nor could you make any bold proposal on behalf of anyone else. And poor Socrates did get hauled up before the court on trial for his life at the end of his life. He also had to participate in various political things. He was quite unsuccessful at that. So there's a lot of truth to this. This is foreshadowing Socrates' fate. So there's more in this vein. 486a or around that. As it is, if someone got a hold of you or of anyone else like you and took you off to prison on the charge that you're doing something unjust when in fact you aren't, be assured that you wouldn't have any use for yourself. You'd get dizzy, your mouth would hang open, and you wouldn't know what to say. You'd come up for trial and face some no good wretch of an accuser and be put to death if death is what they'd want to condemn you to. And yet, Socrates, how can this be a wise thing, the craft which took a well-favored man and made him worse, able neither to protect himself nor to rescue himself or anyone else from the gravest dangers, to be robbed of all his property by his enemies, and to live a life with absolutely no rights in his city? He's saying that philosophy is all well and good as part of liberal education, but when you grow up and become a man, you need rhetoric for what? For self-defense. Now, Socrates responds to this gently. Maybe I don't think he's being sarcastic here. This is at 486d. This is an incredibly arrogant and condescending speech, obviously. And Socrates was a normally constituted man. He was probably very irritated by this, but he maintains his cool. And he says, if I actually had a soul made of gold, Callicles, don't you think I'd be pleased to find one of those stones on which they test gold? He's talking about a touchstone. A touchstone is a stone where if you rub gold on the surface, it leaves a little line, and you can compare the colors of the different carats of gold and determine the relative purity of the gold that you've touched to the touchstone. That's what he's talking about. And if this stone to which I intended to take my soul were the best stone, and it agreed that my soul had been well cared for, don't you think I could know well at that point that I'm in good shape and need no further test? What's the point of your question, Socrates? Socrates is saying that Callicles is a touchstone. If he can hold his own in a debate with Callicles, that is an indication that he's offering 24 karat arguments. Basically, that's the point he's making. Socrates continues, I know well that if you concur with what my soul believes, then that is the very truth. I realize he's a hard sell. He's a hard sell, and if so, Socrates sells him on this, it's a pretty good indication that Socrates is right. I realize that the person who intends to put his soul to an adequate test to see whether it lives rightly or not must have three qualities, all of which you have: knowledge, goodwill, and frankness. His frankness could also be phrased as shamelessness, a certain lack of shame. He's not unwilling to speak shameful things if he feels it's necessary, because he's emancipated from the social conventions that hemmed in Polus and Gorgias. That was his point earlier. I run into many people who aren't able to test me because they're not wise like you. Others are wise, but they're not willing to tell me the truth because they don't care for me the way you do. As for these two visitors, Gorgias and Polus, they're both wise and fond of me, but rather more lacking in frankness and more ashamed than they should be. So he agrees with Callicles' accusation against them. A little above 488, Socrates says, most admirable of all, Callicles, is the examination of those issues about which you took me to task, that of what a man is supposed to be like, and of what he's supposed to devote himself to, and how far when he's older and when he's young. He's talking about education, basically, here, moral education especially. For my part, if I engage in anything that's improper in my own life, please know well that I do not make this mistake intentionally, but out of my ignorance. And then he goes forward. He says, please restate your position for me from the beginning. What is it that you and Pindar hold to be true of what's just by nature? That the superior should take by force what belongs to the inferior? That the better should rule the worse, and the more worthy have a greater share than the less worthy? You're not saying anything else, are you? Do I remember correctly? And Callicles says, yes, that's what I'm saying. And then Socrates starts logic chopping here a bit, trying to get clear exactly what is being said here by Callicles. So let's look into this. So what do you mean by better, basically, and superior? Does that mean stronger? And Callicles says, yeah, the superior is the strong. And then Socrates says, this is at 488d, now, aren't the many superior by nature to the one? They're the ones who, in fact, impose the laws upon the one, as you were saying yourself a moment ago. Callicles says, of course. So the rules of the many are the rules of the superior. Yes, they are. Aren't they the rules of the better? For by your reasoning, I take it, the superior are the better. Yes. And aren't the rules of these people admirable by nature, seeing that they're the superior ones? That's my view. Now, isn't it a rule of the many that it's just to have an equal share, and that doing what's unjust is more shameful than suffering it, as you yourself were saying just now? Or is this not so? Be careful that you, in your turn, don't get caught being ashamed now. He's saying, I'm getting you. Your ears are going to start turning red. Do the many observe, or do they not observe, the rule that it's just to have an equal and not a greater share, and that doing what's unjust is more shameful than suffering it? Don't grudge me your answer to this, Callicles. I'm sure you can just imagine Callicles is blushing at this point because he realizes he's been caught. Don't grudge me your answer to this, Callicles, so that if you agree with me, I may have my confirmation from you, seeing that it's the agreement of a man competent to pass judgment. All right, the many do have that rule. So what's he argued here? He's saying, look, Callicles, you believe that the law of nature is that the strongest should rule, and you think that the strongest are the great men, and that great men should rule over others and have more. They should have more than their fair share. And he's talking about, well, any kind of tyrant, any kind of king, any kind of potentate, any kind of emperor. They rule over many other men, and they have more than other men. And Socrates says, well, but aren't the many stronger than the few? Even incredibly superior individuals. Aren't the many stronger than the few? And if the stronger set the rules, then the many are the stronger. And therefore, shouldn't the rules that are set in place by the stronger, namely the demos, the many, shouldn't we admire this? Shouldn't we think this is right? Isn't that what's right by nature? If what's right by nature is that the strong rule, aren't the many the strong? And therefore, isn't their rule just? Now, this is a very strong argument. It implicitly anticipates an argument by Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes argues in his book Leviathan for political egalitarianism. And his political egalitarianism is based on human equality. And what does human equality consist in for Hobbes? Well, as a teacher of mine, a political philosophy teacher of mine put it, you might be big and tough, but you got to sleep sometime. And when you're asleep, some of us skinny guys are going to get together and jump you, stick a knife in you. And that's the end of your superiority. Hobbes's point is that all men are equal, basically, because no man is bulletproof. No man is so superior to others that a crowd of his inferiors, each one taken as an individual inferior to him, couldn't get together and kill him. That's what human equality consists in for Hobbes. It's the power of the many to overthrow anybody who claims to be, you know, have the right to rule based on his physical superiority or his mental superiority for that matter. If you really believe in might makes right, and that's what we're talking about here, then you should believe in the rule of the many rather than the rule of the few. Now, this is just intolerable to Callicles, because Callicles isn't really thinking of the right of the superior entirely in physical terms. Maybe on the surface, that's what he thinks he's talking about. But at the core of it, he thinks that the superior man who has the right to rule is more than just strong. And so Socrates wants to get him on record exactly what the superiority of the one or the few that Callicles is arguing for consists in. So let's move forward. At 489, about 489 C, Callicles comes back at Socrates. He says, this man will not stop talking nonsense. Now he's grandstanding to the crowd, right? He's looking around and pointing to Socrates and says, this man will not stop talking nonsense. Tell me, Socrates, aren't you ashamed at your age of trying to catch people's words and of making hay out of someone tripping on a phrase? Do you take me to mean by people being superior anything else than their being better? And better somehow doesn't mean stronger. Haven't I been telling you all along that by better and superior, I mean the same thing? Or do you suppose that I'm saying that if a rubbish heap of slaves and motley men, worthless except perhaps in physical strength, gets together and makes any statements, these are the rules? Well, that's what we initially took him to be saying. And Socrates says, fair enough, wisest Callicles. Explain yourself better, okay? A little further on, he says, tell me once more from the beginning, what do you mean by the better, seeing that it's not the stronger? And my wonderful man, go easier on me in your teaching so I won't quit your school. You're being ironic, Socrates. Now, this is an instance where the Greek word ironic is probably best translated as condescending. You're being condescending, Socrates. No, I'm not, Callicles, by Zethus, the character you were invoking in being condescending with me so often just now. But come and tell me, whom do you mean by the better? I mean the worthier. And then he goes on, but in what are they worthy? So you, Socrates says, so do you see that you yourself are uttering words without making anything clear? Won't you say whether by the better and the superior you mean the more intelligent or any others? Now, this is a bad translation, intelligent here. Because the Greek word that's being translated here is phronesis, which is best translated as prudent. It means practical wisdom. And practical wisdom is the highest kind of wisdom for Plato and Socrates. So in a philosophical dialogue that you're translating, it seems like a terrible lapse to translate one of the words for wisdom as intelligent rather than either wise or prudent. So when you see intelligent here, think prudent. Okay, and Callicles says, yes, I mean the superior, the better, or the more prudent, the wiser in the practical sense. Socrates goes on, so on your reasoning, it will often be the case that a single prudent man is superior to countless imprudent ones, that this person should rule and they be ruled, and that the one ruling should have a greater share than the ones being ruled. This is the meaning I think you intend. And Callicles says, yes, that's what I do mean. Now, at this point, we can still debate what Callicles and Socrates think prudence means. They might have different understandings of prudence. Socrates' understanding of prudence is inherently connected with the better, with the good. It's the ability to make right use of all things, which is what philosophy pursues a la Socrates and a la Plato. We're still not clear what Callicles thinks prudence means, but he says that the prudent one should rule the countless imprudent ones, which almost sounds like Socrates' view in Plato's Republic and elsewhere, that philosophers should be kings, or that kings should become philosophical. They should become wise. Okay, so we're getting into the meat of this now. This is real political philosophy here, folks. And we're about at the midpoint, so we're right on time here. Okay, so let's just take a step back here. Socrates sums up at 490a, so on your reasoning, it will often be the case that a single intelligent person, a single prudent person, is superior to countless imprudent ones, and this person should rule and they be ruled. Okay. And Callicles says, yes, that's what I mean. This is what I take the just by nature to be, that the better one, the more prudent one, that is, both rules over and has a greater share than his inferiors. And Socrates says, okay, hold it right there. What can your meaning be this time? Suppose we were assembled together in great numbers in the same place as we are now, and we held in common a great supply of food and drink. And suppose we were a motley group, some strong and some weak, but one of us, being a doctor, was more intelligent about these things. He would very likely be stronger than some of the weak and weaker than others. Now, this man being more prudent than we are, namely prudent in the sense of his area of specialization, namely being a doctor, will certainly be better and superior in these matters. So what Socrates is doing is he's saying, look, there are lots of different areas in which people can be prudent. There are lots of kinds of expertise. And now what prudence is shading off into is craft, techne again, art, which was something we talked about in the very first lecture when we were talking about Gorgias. So this is a little ambiguous here, what's going on, because the trouble with techne is that it's not necessarily wise in the moral sense. But let's just move forward. There are many different kinds of prudence, practical wisdom. So what are you saying at this point? Are you saying that the man who has practical wisdom about food and drink should have the most food and the most drink? Are you saying that the man who has practical wisdom about medicine should have the most medicine? Are you saying that the man who is wise in the ways of weaving should have the most clothes or the biggest garments, that the prudent shoemaker should have the biggest shoes or the most shoes, like Imelda Marcos, for instance? Or the farmer, a man who's prudent and admirable and good in his use of the land, should he have the greater share of seed? Right? He goes on in this vein, and Callicles gets annoyed. How you keep on saying the same thing, Socrates? But Socrates is pointing out something here. He's saying that prudence can be divided up in areas of expertise. And if we should be ruled by the prudent man, and the prudent man should have a greater share than his inferiors, are you really saying that the doctor deserves to take the most medicine and the dietitian deserves to eat the most food? Obviously, that's crazy. Because if these people are really prudent, if these people are really wise, they're going to realize that that's beside the point, right? The best shoemaker should have the best fitting shoes, but that doesn't mean that he should have more shoes than anybody else. A doctor should be in superlative health. A dietitian should eat well. And eating well, being in good health, having well-fitting shoes is not the same as having more than the rest, right? And so Socrates is really honing in on this idea that if somebody's wise, he deserves a greater share of things than others. And the conflict here is between wisdom and acquisitiveness. And this is bringing us to the second feature of sophistry. When we looked at the Gorgias discussion, the discussion with Gorgias, Gorgias argues that rhetoric, the political science that he teaches basically, is stupendously powerful. Why? Because it can control the affairs of the city. It can make the doctor and the cobbler and the weaver your slave, basically. It is a techne, it is an art that has the power to rule over all the other arts and subordinate them. It's all-encompassing and all-subordinating. And yet, it is not necessarily good. It is not necessarily guided by the good. And later in the conversation with Polus, Socrates emphasizes that. In fact, he draws a systematic distinction between what sophistry is involved in and what true political art is involved in. Sophistry is not guided by the good, it's guided by pleasure. Whereas the true political art is guided by the good, and therefore it becomes philosophical. It's genuinely prudent. But sophistry, the false political art, is all about pleasure. And now we're getting a sense of exactly how it relates to pleasure. Limits. Wisdom always involves limits. A wise person can say enough is enough. He can say, well, there can be too much of a good thing. And too much of a good thing is a bad thing. Having the ability to draw the line, to impose limitations, is essential to wisdom. However, what Callicles is talking about here, and we see this more clearly very soon, is he is not guided by wisdom so much as he's guided by appetite, by desire. And appetite is by its very nature infinite. Which means that the form of society that is being advocated by the sophists is, you can call it a technocracy, because it is ruled by a comprehensive, all-subordinating technical skill set. And the question of enough never occurs to it. The answer is always more. So it's an acquisitive society. It's an acquisitive society ruled by technique. Because wisdom doesn't come in, it has no ability to impose limits on itself. Now, you come up against limits with natural limits and things like that. The unlimited acquisition of goods can cause problems, right? Well, these problems will be managed by the ruling technique, by the technocracy. It's a picture of the world that we live in today. It's the picture of the dystopia we live in today. So I think this is really fascinating. So let's dig more into this, but let's take a break and see if there are any questions here. Okay, ABC is written in with 10 US dollars. Thank you so much. Callicles, a gay man, believes in the natural law, the strong and the smart, the weak and the stupid, pursuit of immediate pleasure. Socrates proposed sacrifice for the common good, moderation and everything. Long term, we'd all be dead and forgotten. So why not take Callicles' side? Well, first of all, I wouldn't call Callicles gay. This is just a... That's a somewhat anachronistic idea. Callicles was probably simply practicing Greek homosexuality, which was different from being gay. In what sense? Well, generally what happened is Greek gentlemen would marry and have families and carry on passionate relationships with men on the side. And generally, mature men would have, who were more established in life, would have younger boyfriends. And this was just the pattern of the aristocracy in Athens. So I'm not sure what bringing in gay is. Callicles, a gay man, believes in the natural law, the strong and the smart of the weak and stupid, the pursuit of immediate pleasure. Socrates proposed sacrifice for the common good and moderation and everything. Long term, we'd all be dead and forgotten. Why not take Callicles aside? well, I don't even think Callicles would agree with that. I think Callicles has a... but there's an important point here. I guess it's in the long run, we're all dead, right? the claim of... a guy who really was homosexual, John Maynard Keynes, in the long run, we're all dead. So why think about the long run? Well, the trouble with that is that it's quite egocentric. It's the idea that the only things that matter to you are the things that happen to you within your lifetime. And when you die, the world ends. The only thing that's really significant is the stuff that stimulates the surfaces of your body, the stuff that passes through the tubes in your body. You don't have to think about anything more long-term, like truth, which is more enduring than your life, or culture, which is more enduring than an individual life, or your family going backwards and going forward, which are more enduring than an individual life, or your people, and so forth. It's just a radical form of egocentrism. Ultimately, it's false. It's false because there's more to life and value than just what's contained within our mean little sacks of skin and our mean little lifespans. That's my take on it. Okay, so let's move forward. Anyway, Socrates gets Callicles to be more specific. Callicles is annoyed talking about shoemakers and cleaners and cooks. And Socrates says, well, who do you want to talk about then? Who is the superior and more intelligent or more prudent man that you're talking about then? And Callicles says, this is at 491a, I've been saying it all along. First of all, by the ones who use, by the ones who are superior, I don't mean cobblers or cooks, but those who are prudent about the affairs of the city. The politicians, in other words, statesmen, about the way it's to be well managed, and not only intelligent, but also brave, competent to accomplish whatever they have in mind without slackening off because of softness of spirit. And Socrates says, well, you're wavering and wobbling around because you said more intelligent, more prudent, but then you add brave to this as well. What are these people better and superior in? And Callicles is getting frustrated. I've already said that I mean those who are prudent in the affairs of the city and brave too. It's fitting that they should be the ones who rule their cities. And what's just is that they, as the rulers, should have a greater share than the others, the ruled. Brave, by the way, the Greek word for brave is also the Greek word for manly. So those who are prudent and manly, basically, those are the ones who should rule and have more. And then Socrates says, okay, they should rule others and have a greater share than the others. And then Socrates says, but what of themselves, my friend? What of what? Ruling or being ruled? What do you mean? I mean, each individual ruling himself. Or is there no need at all for him to rule himself, but only to rule others? What do you mean, rule himself? Nothing very subtle, just what the many mean, being self-controlled and master of oneself, ruling the pleasures and appetites within oneself. Now, what's being translated here as self-control is the Greek word sophrosune, which is often translated as moderation. Sophrosune is one of the central cardinal Greek virtues. Courage and self-control are central virtues for the Greeks, as well as justice and so forth. But sophrosune means self-control. What's it in contrast to? Well, it's contrasted to self-indulgence. At its most basic sense, it just means control over the pleasures of life, control over one's appetites, not eating too much, not drinking too much, not whoring around too much, etc. Why? Because these appetites can be our undoing. We can be enslaved to our appetites. Sophrosune also has the sense of sobriety, and not just sobriety in the case of drink, but sort of being sober-minded, as opposed to hubris, megalomania, or just mania, being immoderate in one's ambitions, having a completely inflated self-image, that kind of thing. Sophrosune is an absolutely central Greek virtue. To which Callicles says, "How delightful you are. By the self-controlled, you mean the stupid. Self-controlled men are stupid men." Now, this is an outrageous statement for a Greek because Sophrosune is such a central virtue. And he's saying, you know, being self-controlled is for losers and suckers. And then he gives another speech here. And I think that this is a wonderful speech. So let's look at this. Just give me a sec. So Callicles goes on, "How could a man prove to be happy if he's enslaved to anyone at all, even himself? Rather, this is what's admirable and just by nature. And I'll say it to you now with all frankness, that the man who will live correctly ought to allow his own appetites to get as large as possible and not restrain them. And when they are as large as possible, he ought to be competent to devote himself to them by virtue of his bravery and his prudence, and to fill them with whatever he may have an appetite for at the time. But this isn't possible for the many, I believe. Hence, they become detractors of people like this because of the shame they feel while they conceal their own impotence." So again, he's talking about slave morality. He's talking about people who are inferior, creating a value system that raises them up and denigrates people who are more powerful than themselves, people that they resent. He continues, "And they say that lack of discipline is shameful, as I was saying earlier. And so they enslave men who are better by nature, while they themselves lack the ability to provide for themselves fulfillment for their pleasures. Their own lack of courage leads them to praise self-control and justice. As for all those who were either sons of kings to begin with or else naturally competent to secure some position of rule for themselves as tyrants or potentates, what in truth could be more shameful and worse than self-control and justice for these people who, although they are free to enjoy good things without any interference, should bring as master upon themselves the law of the many, their talk and their criticism? Or how could they exist without becoming miserable under that admirable regime of justice and self-control, allotting no greater share to their friends than their enemies, and in this way rule in their cities? Rather, the truth of it, Socrates, the thing that you claim to pursue, is like this: wantonness, lack of discipline, and freedom, if available in good supply, are excellence and happiness." The word excellence there is translating arete, which is also translated as virtue. So wantonness, lack of discipline, and freedom, if available in good supply, are virtue and happiness. As for these other things, these fancy phrases, these contracts of men that go against nature, they're worthless nonsense. Callicles isn't mealy-mouthed here. What Callicles is offering is what the Greek called pleonexia. Basically, it's just the idea of always wanting more, of desire without limits, desire without ends. And that's very un-Greek, put it that way. This is hubris that invites nemesis, and Socrates is going to be nemesis here fairly soon because he's going to argue against this. And we'll get into that in the later sessions. We have a couple more pages to look at here. And we're making good time. So we'll have time for some discussion here, should you want it. Okay. So Socrates, where it says 492D in the margin, Socrates says, "The way you pursue your argument, speaking frankly as you do, certainly does you credit, Callicles, for you are now saying clearly what others are thinking but are unwilling to say. I beg you then not to relax in any way so that it may really become clear how we're to live. This is the most important thing for Socrates. What is the best form of life for man? Tell me, are you saying that if a person is to be the kind of person he should be, he shouldn't restrain his appetites, but let them become as large as possible, and then should procure their fulfillment from some source or other, and that this is virtue? Yes, that's what I'm saying. It's interesting. His definition of virtue is actually somewhat equivalent to Ben Franklin's understanding of the virtues. Ben Franklin has a completely instrumental conception of virtues. Virtues are basically tools for satisfying yourself. So Callicles is a very modern thinker. Again, you can understand philosophical modernity on the model of sophistry. Philosophical modernity begins with writers like Francis Bacon and René Descartes. What they offered was an image of the world where society was ruled by technocracy. And what philosophy promised was long life and plenty. They were setting up a new order, if you will, where you had a comprehensive and all-subordinating technique which would promise peace for mankind, eternal peace, and plenty. The big line constantly going up. More people coming along, having more things forever. In progress, in other words. So, if you will, the modern idea of progress is here in the idea of endless desire, of pursuing endless desires, because that's what progress is supposed to be, endless pursuits and improvements in how we satisfy ourselves. Now, people would say, oh, well, there's moral progress. In terms of things like health and long life, commodious living, things like that, and of course peace as a condition for enjoying all these things. So Callicles and Gorgias are proto-modern figures, and Socrates, in criticizing them, is offering us criticisms that we can use today against modern liberalism and modern technocracy. So it couldn't be more relevant. We're seeing the beginning of ideas here that rule us to this day, and we're seeing alternatives to these ideas, alternatives that didn't win out ultimately in modernity, but perhaps still can. Perhaps these will be the guiding ideas of the future if we have a future. So Callicles says virtue is having unrestrained appetites and procuring their fulfillment. Socrates then goes on at 492e. So then those who have no need of anything are wrongly said to be happy. Those who have no need of anything, people who are content, people who are not empty, anxious, needy, those people are not happy. Most people would think that if you are completely content with your life and don't have any needs, you've got very, say you're just a guy, a simple guy. You're a simple man, you have simple pleasures. And your simple pleasures are easy to fulfill. So you've got a lot of leisure time. Imagine you're a hunter-gatherer. You can fulfill all of your basic needs at the few hours of foraging a day, and you can sit around the campfire and tell stories and stuff like that. You hunt for fun, not for necessity. Whatever. Imagine that. Callicles says, no, this isn't happiness. If these people were happy, stones and corpses would be happiest, because stones and corpses don't need anything. And then they get into some interesting images here. So let's just read through this carefully. there's a lot of interesting ideas tucked away in here. Socrates says, but then that life of those people you'd call happiness is a strange one too. I shouldn't be surprised that Euripides' lines are true when he says, but who knows whether being alive is being dead and being dead is being alive. Perhaps in reality we're dead. Once I even heard one of the wise men say that we are now dead and that our bodies are our tombs, and that the part of our souls in which our appetites reside is actually the sort of thing to be open to persuasion and to shift back and forth. And hence some clever man, a teller of stories, a Sicilian perhaps, or maybe an Italian, he's referring to the Pythagoreans who were settled in Sicily and southern Italy. Okay. And hence some clever man, a teller of stories, a Sicilian perhaps, or an Italian, named this part a jar, pithos, on account of it being a persuadable and suggestible thing, thus slightly changing the name. And fools, he named uninitiated, suggesting that part of the souls of fools where their appetites are located is their undisciplined part, one not tightly closed, a leaking jar, as it were. He based the image on its insatiability. Now, this man, Callicles, quite to the contrary of your view, shows that the people in Hades, meaning the unseen, these, the uninitiated ones, would be the most miserable. They would carry water into the leaking jar using another leaky thing, like a sieve. That's why by the sieve, he means the soul, the man who talked with me claimed. And because they leak, he likened the souls of fools to sieves, for their untrustworthiness and forgetfulness makes them unable to retain anything. This account is on the whole a bit strange, but now that I've shown it to you, it does make clear what I want to persuade you to change your mind about, if I can, to choose the orderly life, the life that is adequate to and satisfied with its circumstances at any given time, instead of the insatiable, undisciplined life. Do I persuade you at all? And are you changing your mind to believe that those who are orderly are happier than those who are undisciplined? Or even if I tell you many other such stories, will you change it none the more for that? The latter thing you said is true, Socrates. I'm not changing my mind. Now, order here, the Greek order is cosmos. He's talking about having an orderly soul. And for Socrates, and you see this especially in the Republic, which goes into this in greater detail, Socrates believes that a healthy soul has a certain order. And philosophy is there to cultivate the proper order of the soul. And the proper order of the soul does not mean having endless appetites and subordinating one's reason as a tool for the endless pursuit of endless satisfaction, basically the rat race. Okay. And Socrates brings in another image from the Pythagoreans. This is 494 D to E. He says, 493 D to E. Suppose there are two men, each of whom has many jars. The jars belonging to one of them are sound and full, one with wine, another with honey, a third with milk, and many others with lots of other things. And suppose that the sources of each of these things are scarce and difficult to come by, procurable only with much toil and trouble. Now the one man, having filled up his jars, doesn't pour anything more into them and gives them no further thought. He can relax over them. As for the other one, he too has resources that can be procured, though with difficulty, but his containers are leaky and rotten. He's forced to keep on filling them night and day, or else he suffers extreme pain. Now, since each life is the way I describe it, are you saying that the life of the undisciplined man is happier than that of the orderly man? When I say this, do I at all persuade you to concede that the orderly life is better than the undisciplined one, or do I not? And Callicles says, no, you do not, Socrates. The man who has filled himself up has no pleasure anymore. The word pleasure there is hedone, from which we get the word hedonism. Okay, he has no pleasure anymore. And when he's been filled up and experiences neither joy nor pain, that's living like a stone, as I was saying just now. Rather, living pleasantly consists in this, having as much as possible flow in. And Socrates says, well, isn't it necessary then that if there's a lot flowing in, there should be also a lot going out, and that there should be big holes for what's passed out? Callicles says, certainly. Now you're talking about the life of a stone curlew instead of that of a corpse or a goose, a stone. Now, we don't know what a stone curlew is, but I remember my mother would say to me when I ate too much as a child, she said, you've got a gut like a goose. Meaning you're just a tube. This food just keeps going through you, right? He's talking about having a gut like a goose instead of being a stone or a corpse. Basically, Callicles says the best life is to be a tube with two ends and to have as much stuff passing through this tube as possible. That's the image of his life, the good life. Tell me, as Socrates says, do you say that there is a thing called hunger and eating when one is hungry? And so what Socrates now begins here is the next arguments that we're going to deal with in the next session. Basically, at this point, Callicles has advanced a thesis that's come to be called hedonism, which is that the good life is a life of pleasure. Pleasure is the good. And so Socrates is going to turn to refuting hedonism, and that will be the topic of our next class. So we basically come to the end of what I wanted to cover today. So let's see if there are some questions and comments here. So Friedrich writes in with $10. Thank you very much. He says, hi, thank you so much for these lectures. Cheers. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying them. Over at Odyssey, there are 44 people listening. Over at DLive, we have 24. So that's not bad. This is philosophy after all. It's actually the largest philosophy class I've ever taught. So this is good. So let's just check and see if there are questions here, questions, comments, and of course, DLive tokens, things of that nature. So Board Troll has donated one lemon. Thank you very much. And Gadius Maximus sends in a question. He says, Greg, you said in the last Gorgias stream that the concern for the soul shouldn't be compared to Christianity, but come on, if it's better to suffer injustice than to be unjust to one another, and turn the other cheek aren't exactly the same thing. They're at least in the same ballpark, right? Well, I think this is a great question to talk about. Let's talk about the Greeks and Christianity. I'm a great admirer of a writer named Simone Weil, W-E-I-L. She was a French Jewess who died during the Second World War. It's not what you think. She died in London. She had some mental problems. She starved herself to death, basically, in a hospital. But she was a brilliant thinker. And one of the most brilliant essays I've ever read about Homer is her essay called The Iliad, or The Poem of Force. And I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. There's an entire collection of her writings called Intimations of Christianity Among the Ancient Greeks. I think this is an extremely useful book for correcting, I think, a false image of the Greeks and a false image of Christianity. There's the Nietzsche view of the Greeks, where Nietzsche opposes the Greeks to Christianity. Christianity is sort of an anti-Greek worldview. Christianity is the revenge of the Jews, overthrowing the Greek world, etc. If you read Simone Weil, it's a very different view. She talks about a Helleno-Christian tradition rather than a Judeo-Christian tradition. She thinks that there's no such thing as a Judeo-Christian tradition. She thinks that Christianity is a Hellenic rejection of Judaism, of the value system of Judaism based on Hellenic values. In her essay on the Iliad, she talks about how the message of the Iliad sounds all very mushy and peacenicky, which is the Iliad is about learning how to see others through the eyes of other people. It's about the dangers of wrath and about the ability to basically experience sympathy for other human beings. So I thought that was a very interesting take on something that is too often given a kind of Robert E. Howard interpretation. So it's not unheard of to claim that there are parallels between the value system of Christianity and the value system of Hellenism, and that would include people like Plato, or even Homer, or Euripides. These are all figures that are discussed in Weil's book. So it's not unheard of, definitely. Just to repeat this, Greg, you said in the last Gorgias stream that the concern for the soul shouldn't be compared to Christianity. Yeah, they're not exactly the same thing, but they're certainly in the ballpark. So turn the other cheek. What is the turn the other cheek thing? Well, for me, I think that we have to understand things like the Sermon on the Mount as specifically addressed to Jews. Jews are an insanely wrathful race of people. There's no question about it. They're the never forget, never forgive people. Well, what do you want to do if you want to communicate to insanely wrathful people who are given to endless bitterness and fantasies of vengeance? You try and teach them the opposite values. And what are the opposite values of insane wrathfulness and brooding, embittered dreams of vengeance? Well, it's forgive and forget rather than never forget, never forgive. It's turn the other cheek rather than reach for your sword, right? And this actually fits in with Hellenism too. In this sense, Aristotle talks about the virtues as means. The virtuous act, the courageous act, for instance, can be understood as a mean between two extremes. One is an act of cowardice, and the other is an act of foolhardiness. So it's hard to be virtuous because every virtue has at least two vices that you can that go along with it, that you can fall into, a vice of excess and a vice of defect. You can be too manly, which courage means manliness. You can be too manly, which is to be foolhardy, or you can be insufficiently manly, cowardly. That's just the way it is. So Aristotle says, how do you deal with vices? What's the therapy for vice? And he says, well, one of the therapies for vice is to aim for the opposite vice. So, for instance, if you have a tendency to be cowardly, you should aim to be foolhardy. Just as an archer aims a little high, knowing that there's going to be gravity that will pull the arrow down to the target. So, to get hit the vice, if you have a tendency towards vice, you have to aim for the opposite vice, and then you are more likely to hit the mean, which is the virtue. I look at things like turn the other cheek. And I think, well, this is an extremist position. In and of itself, it's a vice, frankly. But you can understand this vice as a corrective to the vices of the Jews, their insane wrathfulness. So, I think that you can have a Hellenic-spirited conversation with things like the Sermon on the Mount. You can understand the teaching of Jesus in this Hellenic spirit. The other thing that it implies is that races of people who aren't given to overweening ethnocentrism, insane wrath, endless ruminations and brooding over past ills, that they don't need this kind of advice. And in fact, it would be bad for them to follow it. So those are my thoughts on the Sermon on the Mount. You can understand it as a Hellenically spirited teaching tool, but honestly, I don't think that Europeans need these values or these lessons. They don't need them in the same way that Jews do. And frankly, we have no future taking such teachings out of context because they don't improve us. They improve Jews, but they don't improve Europeans. Those are my thoughts. Okay, let's see if there's some other questions and comments here. That's a great question, though, and I appreciate it very much. Weil is spelled W-E-I-L. Yeah, Simone Weil. Okay. Let's see if we have any questions, comments, et cetera, at... What if your vice is getting drunk and needlessly arguing with people online? Interesting question. what would the virtue be here that would help you? Well, the virtue obviously would be being a teetotaler. And the opposite vice, let's put it this way, the opposite vice would be being a teetotaler and not getting into any arguments at all. Or agreeing with everybody online. Now, that would be a terrible vice. You would have to torture your soul to agree with everybody online. So if you think that you're getting drunk too much and arguing too much online, aim to never drink and agree with everybody online, and you'll probably get to the virtuous mean. Those are my thoughts. Yes. So Dino writes in, I am pro-technocracy, very unfashionable in these circles, but like guns, it's the guns that kill people. Well, yeah. Well, but doesn't that mean, okay, you're saying that the guns aren't to blame. The technology isn't to blame. It's people that are to blame. And people need to rule over the guns. Okay. But that's not the same thing as technocracy. Why is that? Well, because to say that technocracy is to say that technology needs to rule over technology, basically. Experts need to rule over experts. Whereas we need something outside technology. We need something outside experts. Or we need a different kind of experts. And those are people who are experts in doing the right thing, including setting limits on things. We need wisdom, in other words. We don't need technocracy. We need wise statesmanship. And technocracy is a terrifying thing because as technology grows in power, the necessity of using it well becomes even more urgent. And you can't just punt this to other techniques, right? I sort of had a we're all doomed feeling, a kind of cold chill when I was reading up on AI research and found out that one of the main advocates of AI research was actually saying that, yes, there are all kinds of issues that we need to address in the use of AI, but we're not intelligent enough to figure that out. And so maybe the AIs will tell us. It's like, that's insane. Basically, these people are saying that they're going to create a god to rule over us. No sane person would create a higher form of life to rule over them. However, I guess I can kind of understand the desire for that because it's almost as miraculous as having philosophers rule, right? Having intelligent, benevolent machines is almost as miraculous as the idea of philosophers becoming kings or kings becoming philosophical. But it's not, put it this way, I think that's, I think it's more likely that philosophers could become kings or kings could become philosophical. It's certainly necessary. And thinking that the machines are going to control the machines is just insane. Again, any kind of technical instrument is by its nature morally neutral. Wouldn't AI be that way? Wouldn't it need somebody to use it, somebody to apply it? And so if you kick the can to another machine, then the question becomes, well, is this machine being used well? We can't just have a self-regulating technocracy without the external supplement of wisdom, which is just something that doesn't compute for technocrats. They don't understand that there's a fundamental difference in kind between being able to do something and being wise to do something or choosing not to do it. Just because you can do something doesn't mean that you ought to do it. Anyway, those are some thoughts here. AI is one more reason why the people in power must be replaced. This is mass intervention. I think that's completely correct. You could really get yourself depressed and black-pilled by looking at the utter potential, you know, the terrifying dystopian potential of AI and how it's developing essentially out of control. Because of hubris and greed and stupidity. And you could really just say, it's over. You know, there are not enough serious men on the planet to deal with these problems. But as far as I'm concerned, it's just a subset of all of our other problems. And it all boils down to getting better people in charge. But one thing that's important to contemplate and to face is just how different the world will have to be to fix these problems. And how many of us are willing to say, for instance, that it's just wrong to think of the world as a place where the big line has to always go up? Shouldn't there be limits? One of the arguments that's being made for ethnic replacement in Europe, this is the legal immigration problem, is Europe's populations are going to shrink. We need to bring in people to make the economy work. The alternative to that for many people is unthinkable. The alternative is, no, we're going to keep the people the same. We're just going to be able to do fewer things economically. The economy is going to have to shrink as the population shrinks. Until we reach some kind of equilibrium where the population stabilizes and starts growing again. You have these German car manufacturers in Hungary who say, we need more people to come in and work in these plants. The proper thing the Hungarian government should say is no, we're not replacing the people of Hungary. Take your capital and go elsewhere. But they'll never do that. Because they can't do that, because it's so fundamentally incompatible with the big line must always go up outlook. The big line has been going up and consuming our social, biological, cultural capital for a very long time, and now it's faltering. And instead of questioning how we got in this situation, maybe taking a few steps back to find, you know, going back to where we branched off and took the wrong road, they're just saying, no, we must keep the economy going by replacing the people. That's insane. The economy is nothing but a tool of a people for survival. If the economy is absolute and the people are fungible, that's a complete inversion of reality that simply has to be repudiated. Yeah. So there's a lot that would have to change to fix this world. And fundamentally, one of the things that has to change is the idea that there are technical solutions to technical problems. Ultimately, you can say, okay, I'll have come up with a technological solution to this technological problem, but the technical system needs something from outside it, and that is wisdom. And wisdom involves imposing limits and deciding not to do certain things that you can do. How we get to that is a huge question. The other thing is that wisdom would do is put limits on desire. The big line should not always be going up. We should not be enslaved by our desires. And that's the world that we live in. And this is the world that Socrates is describing when he talks about the false statesmanship of the sophists. What is the false statesmanship of the sophist involve? It involves pandering to the people. And what does pandering mean? It means basically pandering to their desires. And desire by its nature is infinite. And therefore, it's no foundation for anything. It has to be controlled by something higher rather than pandered to and made king. You know, either we live in a world where desire is king, which means that ultimately we will come crashing into certain hard ecological limits. And we will also crash into just dysgenics and cultural corruption too. Because once we have the technological means to sever sex from reproduction, it was only a matter of time before hedonism would spell the demographic decline and death of any people that embraces it. Yeah. Anyway, so let's just see if there are any other questions here and we can wrap up. We're almost at 2 hours. Luxury is more ruinous than war, Juvenal. This is true. Luxury makes you unserious, and war makes you serious. This is why William James talked about the necessity of a moral equivalent of war. Something to shock people out of the unseriousness and self-indulgence of basically a desire-ruled society, which is what America, even in his time, was. That's what all of modernity was set out to be. And America was ahead of the curve. even around the late 19th century. So Friedrich writes in, how do you train for wisdom, or is it innate? Well, it sort of is innate. Plato tells a kind of myth about this. Socrates tells a myth about how philosophical dialectic seems to be a process of recovering things that we already know. So you engage in a philosophical argument and you come to a conclusion, and it's like you recognize something that you've already known. For instance, there is an argument in the opening of Plato's Republic where they're talking about what justice is. And they offer various definitions of justice. So one person says, well, justice is basically minding property relationships. Libertarians would love that one, right? And Socrates says, well, wait a second here. What if somebody loans you a weapon, and then he comes to you and he's not in his right mind and he wants the weapon back because he wants to kill somebody with it, maybe himself, somebody else. Is justice saying, well, it's your property, I'm going to hand it over to you and hope for the best? That's what some bullet-headed libertarian would say, right? Property rights are the foundation of civilization. Yes, I will return your gun to you and just pray that the invisible hand makes sure that you don't kill somebody with it. That's insanity. We know better when we recognize the absurdity of defining justice as merely respecting property rights. That's in virtue of the fact that we already know better what justice is, but we can't yet articulate it. We've had one articulation entertained, namely it's respecting property rights, but when you think that through and you look at concrete instances, you realize, no, that's not good enough. How do you know it's not good enough? It's only in virtue of the fact that in some way you already know what justice is. And justice is one of the virtues. And being a just man is being wise in a particular way. So in a way, yes, wisdom is innate. We seem to already know what it is. And the experience of philosophical dialectic is like an experience of recollecting something that we already knew, but we hadn't been able to put into words. So that's a fascinating question. It's a great question. And we don't really have time to get into it in any more detail than that, but this is to be continued, definitely. So let's see if there are any more questions here. I am going to check entropy. Okay, we have 10 US dollars from ABC, thank you. Translating the Callicles-Socrates dialogue into a geopolitical context, could you say that most of the African societies are a reflection of natural order in pursuit of immediate pleasure? Will society like Japan or 19th century Europe follow Socratic principles of order and moderation? Well, yeah, I would say that. Even Africans don't do everything for comfort. They have all kinds of strange customs. You know, those big plates in their lips, those aren't comfortable, right? That's culture, not just comfort, not just hedonism. So I wouldn't draw that distinction too strongly. But yes, you certainly can say that more traditional Eastern and Western societies are not ruled by hedonism. They are ruled by other things. They're ruled by moral standards, aesthetic standards, religious principles, and so forth. And they're not ruled by comfort. They're not ruled by hedonism. They're not ruled by the constant pursuit of satisfying endless desires. endlessly multiplying desires for trivial things. Earlier societies, more traditional societies, are not set up that way. They have a notion of a kind of sacred order, and they have notions of things that should not be pursued in any circumstances. They have a sense of limits. They have a sense of what's right and wrong, good and bad, beautiful and ugly, shameful and so forth. And that is a kind of cosmos, a kind of order of the soul and of society that breaks down whenever a society is reconfigured around the pursuit of desire. Because again, desire is infinite, it's limitless, it abolishes limits, it abolishes structure, it abolishes morals, and it abolishes civilization eventually. And consumer society has a downward tendency built into it. If you want to make a lot of money, what do you do? Do you put out things that require people to think hard and read hard and study and become better people? Or do you put out stuff that panders to their given preferences and makes them feel good just the way they are? Obviously the latter. And that can only lead to cultural decline. So anyway, we have come to the end of today's lecture. So tune in next week. We will go forward and we will look at Socrates's, I think, very powerful and to this day valid critique of the idea that pleasure is the good, the thesis of philosophical hedonism.